folks who have not finished races well in the past are going to do it today. Here they come another time. Get the last lap. Get the final.
Welcome to F1Weekly.com. My name is Clark Rogers. I'm the host of the program.
Fun fan for years.
F1Weekly.com podcast.
I'm going to do tire changes maybe next year. I think we
Desiree, I'm your fabulous, fierce female Formula One fan.
Fisichella, bravo!
Welcome to F1Weekly.com. My name is Clark Rogers. I'm the host of the program. I'll be joined by Steve Faub, my co-host. This is podcast number 1116, October 13th, 2025, Stephen.
This F1 Weekly podcast brought to you by Yahoo Ads. Yahoo Ads get you the F1Weekly.com website for the ads that interest you. From business ventures to ringtones, Yahoo Ads get you the stuff you really want. Click on them. You know you want to.
Thank you, Steve, and thank you, Yahoo Ads. On today's program, Palou testifies in court. Zach Brown promised F1 dreams until that dream burst into Oscar Piastri's direction. George may be looking elsewhere, and Fernando's dream of competitive car for 2026 could fizzle a la Palou. And in this week's Nasser Hamid Corner, we remember Jules Bianchi, because it's important. Our interviews, Peter Nygaard of GrandPrixPhoto.com and Indian driver Jenna Daruvala. And yes, we do need your contributions to keep this program on the air. Just click on the Support F1 Weekly tab. You know, you'll want to. So there you have it. And there you go. The big court hearings in London. Palou testifying on the stand that he was manipulated by Zach Brown into believing that he was going to Formula One in 2023. And then he was listening to his iPod and heard an interesting news flash. Oscar Piastri is signed away from Alpine to McLaren. And young Palou said that I've been shafted. Yes, indeed, the Isaac Hayes CD came in the mail. So, interesting, Zach Brown turns around and sues him for $30 million, and now it's all going down in the courthouses of London. It's fascinating. I can't imagine Zach getting out of this one with $30 million. I think Palou is in the right, and all the evidence points to that. So, Alex Palou is going to be in the clear, I believe. And Zach may have a little egg on his face, but he is Teflon, Zach, and seems to get out of these conundrums easily. But it's quite exciting for the courts in London to have this big Formula One hearing. And of course, IndyCar is involved. And Palou definitely showed a lot of talent, winning four straight IndyCar titles, world championships, whatever they call them. And I think he deserved a shot at Formula One. So it's too bad. Once again, the planets really do have to line up for a lot of these drivers. And it's tough out there, but I do feel for Palou. I think he's talented. I don't know if he talks with Fernando a lot, but the Spanish can get pretty pissed off. So he is standing his ground, and we'll see what happens. I think Palou is going to come out on top. The unfortunate thing is this is going to, it's going to stain his career. Nobody else might want to touch him because he's a contract breaker or whatever you want to call it. So I think the boat may have sailed on his Formula One career, and he's already won four championships in IndyCar. I think he should go into maybe Le Mans or what have you, but he's definitely a talent. And maybe all is forgiven after the trial, and maybe he'll get a shot at this, because now Oscar Piastri, the big rumor is he wants to go to Ferrari. He doesn't like this love fest at McLaren. This really, what most people call it, is nonsense. So we do have interesting movement. We have whispering, and of course, the other whispering, has the Red Bull car always been this good? They just forgot to tighten up a couple of screws. So I don't know. The car hasn't changed visually very much, but now they're talking Max maybe has a shot at this championship. That would be hard to believe, but mathematically he does. So the excitement grows. Let's go right into the Dasher Hamid corner. We remember Jules Bianchi, and this is because it's important to not forget. It's been over 10 years. It happened in 2014. It was awful. We're going to replay some chit-chat from me and Nasser and how it affected us and how terrible it was, and we can never forget Jules Bianchi. That's the way it should be. And of course, we have Peter Nygaard, founder of GrandPrixPhoto.com, outstanding supply of photographs that Nasser used in his calendar a lot. So there you have it. And we do have the Indian driver that Nasser was trying to promote back in the day, Jenna Daruvala. So yes, enjoy that, ladies and gentlemen, and we'll see you in Austin.
I am Christian Rasmussen from Denmark, and you are listening to F1 Weekly.
Welcome back to F1Weekly.com. Clark Rogers here, your host. And now, as we spin the globe and go around the world with Motorsports Mondial and the king, the Swami himself, Nasser Hamid.
Sir, hello to all the F1 Weekly familiar members. Definitely not the weekend we were looking for in the rain in Japan. Back to you, sir.
Thank you, Nasser. On today's program, we all hope for Jules' recovery. And, of course, a big goodbye to Andrea De Cesaris. Nas, welcome to the studio. Of course, we'll have a little Motorsports Mondial. We'll have a little 50 words on the Japanese Grand Prix, and we do have Tech Talk with Tim. Nas, welcome to the studio. Really bad week for Formula One racing, and I mean, everybody's affected by this, especially when you eat, breathe, and think Formula One on a daily basis. It's been brutal.
It has been a very brutal weekend, and it's just, you know, one of those things, Clark. When you thought everything was great, cars are very safe, nothing can go wrong, and we have a terrible situation of all the things under a yellow flag situation. Very, very sad, and it's just terrible what has happened in Japan.
Yes, it's just, you know, and we could put blame anywhere. Why was the race played out so late in the day when they knew that the storm was coming? I mean, everybody knew the timetable. They could have had it earlier in the day. I don't think any of the drivers said that visibility was a problem, but obviously we've had rain in the past. But still, the whole thing seemed to be, you know, something that just, you know, it happened and there's nothing we can do about it. I also agree we shouldn't have any knee-jerk reactions. So, really, to be honest with you, I just want to continue and hope that Jules Bianchi comes out of this coma, because this is a bad situation. Any brain injury is bad.
Yeah, this race was like, you know, the 1973 Indianapolis 500. Just too many things were going on, and then finally we had a couple of fatalities in that race, and this, you know, like you said, we don't want to be pointing fingers. When things go wrong, they go wrong. I mean, we've seen so many races in far worse conditions, and here it was delayed and then started under a safety car, and it's not a situation where the crash happened at the worst time during the race. You know what I'm saying? It was a yellow flag situation, but really, really terrible, and obviously like all major tragedies, hopefully there'll be lessons learned, and motor racing cannot afford another accident like this, that's for sure, not just Formula One.
No, I agree, and I'm sure all of the formulas are looking at this, but just tragic. I mean, so young, you know, a possible seat at Ferrari for this young man, we don't know. A great driver, great family, pedigree, if you might say, history, his father. I mean, this is someone that I would have never thought would have this kind of terrible, terrible tragedy happen to. I mean, it's a mind blower for me.
Oh, yeah, and I got to tell you, Clark, you know, some years ago we started following young drivers because we don't have access to Formula One, and we thought we can, you know, follow some young kids for a few years, and hopefully they'll remember us when they get to Formula One. And there were three kids that we met early part of their careers. Jules Bianchi was one of them. Esteban Gutierrez was one of them. Alexander Rossi was one of them. Two of them have made it to Formula One. Rossi, very deservedly, is knocking on the door. And, you know, of all the drivers we have met, Jules Bianchi is the one I met most. You know, I'm friends with the gentleman who was handling his affairs before he got to Formula One, Olivier Menu. Met him so many times, met him in Malaysia, Italy, all over. And even last January when I was at Jerez with Dr. Miguel, Jules came up to me and said hello, and we had a, you know, brief chat. Just a very nice kid and very, very low-key kind of person, you know. No razzmatazz, no hoo-ha. I just feel terrible. This has hit me very hard. You know, I've been following this business for a long time. We've had the severe situation, Gilles Villeneuve, Ronnie Peterson, the Imola thing. But, you know, to be, you know, somewhat, you know, got to know the person. We interviewed him so many times. I'll tell you what happened. Some years ago, I was at the Autosport show in Birmingham, England, and I saw John Surtees walking, and there was a young kid with him. So, of course, for me, meeting John Surtees, only guy to win championship on 2 and 4 wheels, was a big deal. So I walked up to him and, you know, had a brief chat with him. And when I was leaving, I shook hands with the young kid who was with him, Henry Surtees, of course. And he says, you know, thank you, sir. And when his accident happened, even though I met this kid just for a few seconds, I'm having a hard time getting that event and his tragic accident at Brands Hatch out of my mind. And now this has happened. It's just terrible, terrible. For everybody.
That's the tragic, you know, we follow these young drivers. You know, we're always positive here at F1 Weekly. We never, even the people we don't like, we're nice to. And when somebody that we follow and always hope that they make it to Formula One, to have something like this, it hits you right in the gut. I mean, it hits you really hard.
And, you know, people who are in our age group, you know, we've been following this for 30, 40 years. I mean, we've seen guys like Graham Hill come and go, their son come and become world champion and go, you know, same situation. So obviously we have a lot of passion. We have a feel for the sport like so many people out there. And it just, you know, what really, it has always, what I've always thought, whether it's Jules Bianchi situation, Schumacher or Sever, you know, these racing professional sports for many, many years, if you want to succeed, you have to walk, talk, eat. Everything is, you know, that sport, whatever your chosen profession is. And when you see these young kids, you know, and I've seen a lot of them over the years, you know, lately I've been following the karting scene also quite a bit. You know, you see them at the age of 8, 10 years, young kid, dreaming of Formula One, sacrificing anything and everything that life has to offer to get to Formula One, and then you have something like this. It's just unbelievable.
Yeah.
I don't even know what to say.
No, it's devastating. There's nothing we can do. It's brutal, but...
Also, you know, we're not medical people, so we're not going to speculate on the condition and this and that. But let me... This came on autosport.com today, and some question and answers they had officially from FIA.
Okay.
Shall I read this? And, you know, if people want to read all in detail, they can go to autosport.com. And I'm sure other websites have also posted. May I proceed with your consent, sir?
Absolutely.
Okay. first question is what you've raised is, was it wrong to start the race at 3 p.m.? And this is what Charlie Whiting had to say, and I quote, "Firstly, the race start time is not really a matter for the FIA. I warned them that we would not run the race unless it was safe to run it, and there was a high probability that they would not have a race. They said no, they wanted to stick with 3 p.m. start time, but for me, the race start time is totally unconnected to the incident in question." End of quote. Now, the track owner and promoter is, of course, Honda, and the reason they did not want to hold the race earlier at the last minute is that the track is very far away. You know, it's was built as a testing facility for Honda, so they did not want to have a lot of people show up and find out, oh, the race is already over, and obviously nobody knew what was going to happen. Your thoughts on not changing the time? I mean, did you have any concerns about that?
You know, I had concerns about it after the race, you know, after everything is over. You know, I agree with the track promoters, Honda. You know, you can't start a race 2 hours earlier when you have people driving for hours to get to the track that have paid $300-$500 a ticket. You know, there are limits. I mean, if anything, postpone the race and have it on Monday.
And, you know, they would have never started the race if they felt if there was going to be a serious danger to the drivers.
Of course not. I mean, you know, obviously he doesn't have a crystal ball. And we've seen much worse conditions in our lifetime. This was, for me, I thought it was mild. A lot of the drivers were ready to race. I think all the commentary around the Grand Prix was, it's not that bad. I mean, we've seen Fuji 76. We've seen Spa where it's torrential. This is definitely not torrential rain. On the other hand, we are much more leaning towards safety these days than we did even 5 years ago.
Yeah, and talking about Fuji, just look what happened in 2007. How much rain was there?
Exactly. And that, exactly. To be honest with you, I was surprised with not having a standing start and starting the race behind the safety car, because I didn't see enough rain to justify starting behind the safety car.
Yeah. And the next question asked was, why did the FIA not bring out the safety car to deal with recovery of Adrian Sutil's car? And this is interesting. And this is what Whiting had to say, and I quote, "We put double waved yellows out because we felt the incident could be dealt with without using the safety car. The next stage up is a safety car, but because the car was well away from the track and against the tires, it is the normal procedure for us to follow under those circumstances. We didn't see any need for a safety car," end of quote. This, I have to say, as much as I love Formula One, my two yens on this issue, they must bring out the safety car in similar conditions in the future because, you know, we cannot afford a tragedy like this. Again, motorsports is dangerous, even under yellow flag condition. Do you remember what happened when Montoya crashed into that jet dryer?
Yes, exactly.
Under a yellow flag situation. I was, frankly, and I'm being very honest here, I was very surprised before his accident because, you know, his accident was never shown and you could not even see the car if there was a second car involved. With that heavy crane there with those big tires, I was saying, you know, there has to be a safety car because, you know, a car spinning out of control is still traveling at 100 miles per hour is slow for a Formula One car. So that really caught my attention, and I was kind of surprised.
No, I completely agree. And I think these large tractors on these runoff areas have to go. We have to do what they do in Monaco, which is a crane behind the lines that just reaches down and picks it up without these large vehicles having to actually go on track.
It reminded me of my friend, you know, when we used to watch races together, Professor Rubel. He would always say to me, a racing car on the side of the track is a magnet. You know, long, long time ago, Bobby Rahal in sports car racing was racing at Nürburgring and his car broke down. He walked away and his car was hit by another car that exploded in flame and the driver was killed. So, you know, these things have happened, and with the car on the track, we obviously, what has happened, nobody can change that, unfortunately, but they have to learn from this.
Keep up the good work, Nass. I think we should take a little bit of a break.
And I'll have some Vitel water.
There we go. And we'll be back.
Thank you.
After this brief message.
Honesty is something we all look for, especially when it comes to auto service. Honest Engines Auto Service Tallahassee is where you'll find it. Since 2005, they've been delivering trusted, dependable service to Florida's capital. Honest Engines is your full-service auto repair center. Bumper to bumper, they have you covered. Honest Engines Auto Repair offers a variety of services. Transmission repair, oil change service, and much, much more. Don't let just anyone work on your car. Bring it to Honest Engines. They'll give your baby the care it deserves. They work closely with you to make sure you know what's being done. With Honest Engines, you don't have to guess what their team is doing. Their highly experienced and certified technicians know just what your car needs, and they'll make sure you do too. So if you're in the Tallahassee area and you need auto repairs, give Honest Engines a call. 850-421-8461. And tell them F1Weekly.com sent you. Honest Engines Auto Repair. Right on the corner, right on the price. 718 Gay Street, Tallahassee.
Welcome back to F1Weekly.com. Clark Rogers here, your host. And we're not going to spin the globe, but we're going to spin the zone.
Wow.
Like the factor.
Wow.
And we've got a Peter Nygaard interview. Nass, you've worked with Peter for a while. Man. He's got the book out with your photo on the cover.
What's not on the cover.
I know. I just had to embellish a little bit.
Well, Peter Nygaard has been a Grand Prix photographer. His company is called Grand Prix Photo. A lot of nice pictures there. And he has been supplying me photographs for the calendar. And we've become good friends and always stay in touch. He's a huge, huge Bruce Springsteen fan. His wife is from Germany, and she's also a Bruce Springsteen fan.
Not all of us are perfect.
Yeah, I know. Man, he goes. He was recently in. He goes to South Africa, comes to America 2-3 times just to attend his con. He's like one of those groupies or roadie for the boss. So that's very interesting.
Okay, so born in the USA. No, keep up the good work.
Yeah, he was born in Denmark. So anyway, so this is an interview with him about his thoughts on the preseason testing. And, you know, he goes to all the races and all the test sessions. Good insights. And he knows the Magnussen family very well. So I have a very good chance that if I show up someday in Denmark or Roskilde, I can get an audience with Kevin, depending on the time. So that's the thing. But before that, you know, some other motorsports news, IndyCar news. Major lawsuit going on against the series and Bobby Rahal's team, thanks to National Guard sponsorship moving away from Panther Racing. Panther Racing is owned by, you know, I read this thing. There's a lot of information on this lawsuit on racer.com. I would highly recommend very in-depth reporting, very good reporting. Please check it out if interested. Thing about Panther Racing, you know, this is the racing where J.R. Hildebrand was driving when he crashed in the on the final corner of the 100th Indy 500. Dan Wilden also drove for him. Almost every driver who drove for him ended up suing him for non-payment of, you know, monies. And I'm thinking, you know, Panther Racing, it's not Penske Racing, so it's not a surprise. Then when this lawsuit came out, I mean, I'm sure you have seen National Guard sponsorship on NASCAR and with Dale Jr. and IndyCar Racing. And I had no idea how much money was involved here. Man, this lawsuit has really opened up. Big can of worms. They were paying him about like $10-12 million a year. I mean, you can sponsor a Marussia for that kind of money. But, you know, in return, there was a lot of things they were doing to promote this and that. But $10-12 million, I know for a fact, you can go sponsor a car with Penske. He might even give you a 10% discount on that kind of money. So that was quite an opener. And, of course, he is alleging a lot of things. So good reading on racer.com if interested. Jacques Villeneuve, our good friend, ex-world champion, he is coming back and will race in the Indy 500, which I think is good for the series. And, you know, they cannot get anything done right these days. Why are you shaking your head?
Because he's old. I mean, and I understand it's an oval. He's won it before. That was his big stepping stone into Formula One. Don't get me wrong, Jacques Villeneuve was a superb talent, but I still remember Jacques Villeneuve crashing in a BMW Williams. Robert Kubica took over, and we never saw Jacques again.
Well, you know, when BMW, talking of that time frame, when BMW took over Sauber team, they tried...
Sauber, excuse me, not Williams.
They were trying to get him out, but thanks to his manager, Craig Pollock, he had a very watertight contract. They were paying him like a very large amount. And so that's how, the way things go. A Rally Mexico is going on this weekend. Sebastian Ogier is leading as we speak. And finally, before we bring Peter Nygaard on the show, in Misery Love Company department, both comrade Vitaly Petrov and Paul Di Resta will drive for Mercedes in DTM. Di Resta was champion of the series in 2010. And in case anyone has not heard yet, due to the off-season, Di Resta is related to Dario Franchitti.
Shocking!
Yes.
Well, Dario Franchitti has so much time on his hands now that he will be attending many of the DTM races, which are fun with lots of activities and events.
Yes, and they normally have European Formula 3 Championship as a support race, so it's a good show. And, you know, one good thing that came out of his accident is Ashley Judd came back to his side.
Loving. Yep. That's so beautiful, Nasser. A tear is rolling down my cheek.
Yeah. Achy, breaky heart, but love's back.
That's beautiful, Nass. Keep up the good work. Here we go with Peter Nygaard.
Okay, folks, on the line from Denmark is our good friend, Mr. Peter Nygaard of Grand Prix Foto. Peter, welcome back to F1 Weekly. How are you today, sir?
Thank you very much. I'm very well. Looking forward to the new season.
Good. And how is the weather in beautiful Denmark?
It's springtime at last. It's not too cold anymore, and the snow has gone away, so it looks promising, especially if you go to Australia next week.
Exactly. Now, with all the new changes for 2014, what has been the main difference in this year's preseason testing compared to past several years? And you have attended quite a few of those.
I think the main difference is that everybody seemed far less prepared than in the past. Everybody was having a lot of problems, some teams more than others. But in the past, when we went winter testing, most cars were just ready and ran lap after lap. This time we saw a lot of cars stopping on the track and spending the whole day in the garage while the mechanics worked on them. So everybody was far less prepared than they've seen in the past.
Okay. Peter, I'm just going to give me a 30-second break here. I want to make sure that this thing is working. Yeah, it is. Oh. Yeah, there's a meter that runs thing, you know, the time and all that. So it's working fine. Okay, here we go. Okay, I'm going to go to my next one. Next question, sir. Are the Red Bulls finally slaughtered after many years of Uber domination?
I don't think so. I think they will have a difficult time to begin with, but I'm also sure they have such enormous resources, so many great engineers, and of course Adrian Newey, that sooner or later they will solve their problems. I don't see them as a world champion, or at least I don't see them as Grand Prix winners to begin with. But in the second part of the season, they will be right there, I'm sure. They will solve their problems, and they will challenge for wins again.
Uh-oh, so 5-5 is still a possibility then?
Yeah, it's not impossible because I can see a lot of different winners and some very surprising results in the first half of the season anyway. So it's not like somebody's running away with the championship in the first half of the season. I can see a lot of different winners, as I said. So when Red Bull and Vettel come on steam in the latter part of the season, they might still have a chance to take the championship.
Yeah, I agree with you, and I remember this is what happened in 2010.
Exactly.
Now, you said there may be surprise winners. What kind of results will surprise Peter Nygaard?
I could see Williams. I can see Force India. Maybe not on the top step, but I can see them on the podium for the first few races. And I can see McLaren also, hopefully there. And considering what happened last year, that is a surprise, isn't it?
Yes. I know you are good friends with Jan Magnussen. His son is saying he can do what Lewis did in 2007. Give us a little background, please, on his testing times and performance.
I think Kevin has done very well. He has been faster than Jenson Button in most tests. And I know testing is not perhaps the real picture, but it's always a good start. But I also see McLaren sort of sliding down the order in the last test in Bahrain. They were very fast in Jerez, sort of okay in the first Bahrain test, but last week they were not really up where they where I expected them to be. So maybe the McLaren has reached a sort of level already where it's difficult to develop the car. And if that's the case, they might have another difficult season. I'm not sure. They say there's new parts coming. I spoke to Kevin last night. There's new parts coming. And they had some new parts in Bahrain, which they did not really have the time to run because there were some other problems with the car. But if they go as well as Kevin expect them to, Kevin told me, we're not where we want to be, but we will be there. Don't worry. Then I can see Kevin on the podium in his first season, maybe even on the top step.
Yeah, I understand the technical department at McLaren played a major role in Kevin replacing Senor Sergio. Anything you can share with us on this, please? Because I know you're close to the Magnussen plan.
I just know that the technical people were very impressed by the feedback Kevin could come up with, even after his very first test in Abu Dhabi, 18 months ago, the young driver test in 2012. He impressed them immediately with his feedback, and he's so mature and he's so calm and collected that I'm sure he will be a prominent player in the McLaren team, not only as a driver but also as a sort of technical person.
Yeah, you know, last year in World Series by Renault, he won the championship, had a strong season. But what really got my attention is the second half of the British Formula 3, where, if I remember correctly, he won 7 races, same number as my cousin who won the championship. So I'm expecting good things from Kevin.
Yeah, I think everybody is expecting very big things from Kevin. He is the most exciting newcomer to Formula 1 for the last few years. And I can tell you, Denmark is in Formula 1 fever at the moment. He's on the cover of every magazine. He's in the newspaper every day, TV every day. He's a major star already.
And you have already written a book about him.
Yes, the first Kevin Magnussen book comes out next week when the cars go out to the FP1 in Melbourne. My car will be published here in Denmark. So that's quite exciting.
And I understand the book is in Danish, so if any Danish listeners or people who speak your language want to buy, how do they get a copy of this book?
They will get it in all bookshops in Denmark, and if there are some international listeners interested in the book, I can assure that all the beautiful pictures are in English.
Oh, that's very good. That's nice to know. Okay, Mercedes-powered cars have done very well in pre-season testing. Shall we take it that the winner or the podium will be full of Mercedes-powered cars in Melbourne?
I'm fairly sure that will be the case. The Mercedes engine seems so much stronger than Renault and Ferrari. Not only stronger on horsepower, but also on reliability. So it looks promising for Mercedes.
Is the pace of Williams real, or was it a case of too much Asti Spumanti to impress the folks at Martini and Rossi?
And that's always a question, isn't it? That was my suspicion as well. I mean, you are easily suspicious in this business, aren't you? But it seems that the speed is real to a certain degree. I don't think they will win in Melbourne, but they will be much higher up than we used to. And maybe it's because they built a great car, but the engine plays a major role in that also.
Hey, Martin,
they made a fantastic choice, didn't they? They went from Renault to Mercedes, and it looked a little bit, hey, why are they doing that? Why are they changing engine again? But that was a very, very wise decision.
Yes, and the beautiful Martini paint scheme was, released today as to how it would look on the car. Your thoughts on beautiful Martini colors coming back in Formula One?
It looks great.
Cool. Some intra-team rivalries. Who will be the alpha dog at Scuderia Ferrari, Nando or Kimi?
That's a very good question. I think the fact that they have two very strong drivers and two ex-world champions will be a bigger problem for Fernando than it will for Kimi, because Fernando, we've seen in the past, he's not always very keen on having a strong teammate, is he? On the other hand, Kimi is just so cool, isn't he?
Yes,
he will go up against anybody. And if he beats Fernando, great. If not, he won't care, will he?
Yeah. Yeah, the only time Kimi is upset or he cares is when he goes to the local 7-Eleven in Helsinki and they tell him, sorry, no vodka. That's when he's upset. Okay.
You said that, Nasa. I will not comment on that.
Well, you know, he never talks to anybody, so I'm not going to worry about him doing a chokehold on me. Good. Lotus, Romain or Pastor as the top guy there?
Oh, Romain for sure. He is probably, as I see it at the moment, he is the only strong point in the Lotus lineup. And then the new chess driver, Marco Sørensen, but let's get back to him later.
Yeah, who's also from your country, right?
Exactly. But the Lotus seems to be in very, very serious problems. They missed the first test in Jerez, and they ran very little in both Bahrain tests. And I know Grosjean was not impressed by what is happening. And they have the Renault engine, which is not so strong. Mm-hmm. Grosjean is a great driver, but is he able to lead a team? That's a big question. One of the biggest, most interesting questions in the 2014 season. Is Grosjean really ready to be team leader? Because I don't think he won't have a lot of support, technical feedback and so on from Pastor Maldonado. So it really is a make or break season for Grosjean, I think.
Yeah, when Eric Puyer left Lotus, you know, he was with Chennai Capital for a long time. I really thought that that's pretty much the end of the Lotus team. But then came Pastor with his petrodollars, so good for them.
Yeah.
Toro Rosso, Jev or Kev?
I think Vanya will be the strongest driver to begin with because he has the experience. But this new Russian guy, he seems to be mature and strong. He's very young still, but seems to be fairly mature, fairly confident. But then, of course, how reliable is the Toro Rosso? They one of the teams which changed engines, and they made obviously the bad choice. They went from Ferrari to Renault, and they could have a few problems at least to begin with.
You know, I had met Daniel Kvyat before also, but when I met him this time at the Jerez test, and that was the thing I noticed, that he's very cool and calm and like, you know, I belong here. I was impressed.
Yeah I'm so very impressed by him also. And we saw in a few Friday sessions last year that he came into Formula One and he was impressive immediately, and he was not overwhelmed in any way. So I see good things for him.
Okay. Are you expecting half of the field not seeing the checkered flag because of all these reliability issues we're having?
Yeah, I can see at least half the teams or half the field retiring in Melbourne. We didn't see many cars run race distance in Bahrain, and it could be even hotter in Melbourne than we had in Bahrain. And it's a different circuit. There's not so much cool air because it's just a street circuit and trees around. And I think it could be interesting. And I think if you survive full distance in Melbourne, you will have a lot of points on your account.
Yeah, that's good. Now, yesterday I saw a shocking news item: Azerbaijan Grand Prix. What the Baku is going on in this world? Have they not seen what happened to Korean and Turkish Grand Prix? Your thoughts on this, going to
places? I'm sure they've seen what happened to those two races you mentioned, but they've also seen what happened to Bahrain and Abu Dhabi and some other of the new races. Some new races survive and seems to be a good investment for the country. I mean, have you ever heard of Bahrain before they had Formula One?
Oh, of course.
I think it might just work. There's a street circuit, as far as I know, which is always interesting. So why not? The sad thing is that, from what I heard, it might replace the German Grand Prix. And the Großer Preis von Deutschland, is, as far as I'm concerned, is one of the classic races which must not be left out of the calendar.
So from the land of Rudolf Caracciola, Alfred Neubauer and Schumacher, they're going to the land of Schaschlik.
Maybe, but let's see. It's Bernie is sometimes playing funny games, and maybe the German Grand Prix contract is up for renewal, and it's always good to put some pressure on them, isn't it?
Yeah, there was also talk of them trying to take over the Long Beach Grand Prix from IndyCars. What's the paddock talk on that one?
I think they had a meeting last night, didn't they, in Long Beach, discussing that, the city council or whatever it's called in the States. And,
yeah.
I think it delayed the decision, but it's interesting to see that we might go back to Long Beach. I would love to go back to Long Beach.
No, it would be fantastic to have a race in California.
Yeah, and maybe, who knows, in a few years' time, we might have three races in the States. And why not? Because the United States is a fantastic big country and lots of potential sponsors and viewers and so on. So it might make sense.
Oh, absolutely. And, you know, I was at Texas Race Austin, and what a fantastic facility we have now. Amazing.
Yeah, the United States Grand Prix in Austin is already, after just 2 years, one of the favorite races of the Formula One people. So, and hopefully, Long Beach and maybe New Jersey can do something similar.
And Texas is the best place to have a steak after a Formula One race.
Exactly.
Okay. Now, I think you know the answer to this one, but who do you think will be world champion in 2014 apart from Kevin Magnussen?
You mean who will be second to Kevin?
Yeah, see, I knew you were going to say that.
No, who will be second? Kevin is not going to win the championship, unfortunately. Not this year, but in 2-3 years' time, hopefully. But I think it will be between Lewis and Nico in the Mercedes cars.
Wow. Now, last question is very important. Will Bernie be a jailbird in Germany after the trial?
I don't think so.
Okay, yeah. Money buys a lot of privileges. Like in America...
Sure, it does, but I'm not sure it's a question of money, but I just think even if he's found guilty, and I doubt that very much, even if he's found guilty, what's to win to put a 83, 84-year-old guy in prison?
Yeah, when he can go to Monte Carlo and have a good time, you're right.
Exactly.
Okay, great. Now, I really appreciate your feedback and your time. Any things we should look for? What's your prediction? Anything we should look for in Melbourne?
No, I think it'll just be a very interesting race. It will be probably a quite unusual grid, and it'll be an even more unusual race with lots of retirements, I think.
Great. Okay, Peter, that should wrap up our show. Anything else you want to say off the record?
No. Just mentioning this, Marco Sørensen, who will be the fourth driver at Lotus. It seems to be quite interesting, quite big news here in Denmark, because it's sponsored by one of the biggest banks here in Denmark, Saxo Bank. Mm-hmm. And they have spent a lot of money on bicycling on Tour de France in the last few years. And apparently they are thinking about moving that budget to Formula One and secure Marco Sørensen a seat for 2015.
Yeah, you know, Peter, for some reason I had a couple of questions that dropped out. Can I ask you one more question, please? And we will put it. Okay. Now we have Susie Wolf and Simona Di Silvestro. As part of the F1 teams. As far as Simona is concerned, she was here in IndyCar racing for many years. Do you think she can be the Lella Lombardi of Lugano, or is this just a commercial arrangement?
I think a little bit of both. Maybe it is no secret that Sauber is not the financially strongest team on the grid, and if they can find some money with a female driver, why not? But I also see both her and Susie as quite good drivers. It would be very interesting to see Susie in this Friday session. I think it's in Silverstone and in Germany. She will drive the Williams in the Friday session. I think she will surprise quite a few people. I saw her last year in the young driver test in Silverstone, and she was within a second and a half of a certain Kevin Magnussen in a Williams. So that was not too bad, was it?
I note with interest young driver test.
Yeah, young driver test is a wrong description, but because young driver is defined as a driver who hasn't done more than two Formula One races. So you could be 45 and still be a young driver.
Oh, cool. Okay, Peter, that should do it. Thanks a lot. And when are you flying to Australia?
Monday morning? Yeah.
Oh, wow. Well, if my cousin is there, please say hello for me. And also say hi. Have you met his uncle, Amir?
No. I think I'm sure you will introduce us.
Yeah. It's you met Felipe at Sepang. We introduced you to him. Remember, he was sweating very badly last year. And yeah, his uncle, Amir, who's always there, a gray-haired guy, very nice guy. You will like him. Okay, thank you. Thank you so much, and we'll stay connected. Thank you, sir.
Cheers.
Cheers, bye-bye.
Peter, thanks for joining F1 Weekly. .com. So there you have it. Shortly, yes, we will be viewing Albert Park, celebrating the Fernando victory, and it's going to be exciting, Nasser.
Yes, sir. It will be very, very exciting.
How many kablamos do you expect?
I would say at least six.
Six kablamos?
Yeah.
My God, Batch.
No, they don't have to be engine kablamo.
I understand.
They have so many things going on there, you know.
I hope...
I expect 6 to 8 cars not
finished. Wow, David Hobbs could lose his voice over this.
Yeah.
This is exciting.
Yeah.
So, outstanding. And do you still think that there will be a Grand Prix in Sochi?
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
Keep up the good work.
If they can hold the, Winter Olympics with all that was going on, the track is pretty much, you know, track is part of the complex. It's I read a story that, and, you know, Vladimir Putin has come out and said the Russian Grand Prix is on track
and
to take place. And when Putin talks,
people listen.
State Department listens. And here is some good music. Please enjoy. Ta-ta.
Hopefully we can cheer our listeners with this conversation I had with young American, American Indian racer Jahan Daruwala, who some years ago won the British Karting Championship. He's a pretty good racing talent from India, from Mumbai, previously known as Bombay. So I hope people enjoy this brief chat with Mr. Jahan Daruwala. What say you, sir?
I wish I could pronounce his name, but... thanks for speaking with F1Weekly.com.
Okay, folks, I'm here in Oschersleben, Germany, with a young Indian talent, Jahan Daruwala. Jahan, welcome to F1 Weekly. How are you today?
I'm good, thanks. How are you?
Very good, sir. Thanks. Now, you were part of the One in a Billion driver search from India. Give us a little background of how that search went and how many people were involved.
I mean, there were many drivers who took part. There were more than 2,000. And out of them, they only chose 100 in the first few. And I was one of those 100 to begin with, and they shortlisted those to 10, and then to 3. And out of those 3, we did a whole championship in Britain last year. And then I was chosen as the only one.
I was talking to your dad earlier, and he said he did not have any interest. How did you interest in racing? How did you pick up interest in motorsports?
I mean, since I was a kid, I used to watch Formula One on TV. And I love Fernando Alonso, and since then, I've always been interested in racing.
How big is karting scene in India? I know there are quite a few drivers from India past several years, but in terms of facilities and opportunities, what's the scene?
I mean, it's a bit different because it's not as much, you don't spend as much money there, so there's a lot less drivers because they can't really afford it. So each class is only 12 to 15 maximum, and there's only one championship with 5 rounds in it, so it's a lot different here. We do about 25 races a year over here and spend most of our life racing.
You like that kind of life?
Yeah, love it.
Okay, now, how much racing did you do in India before you came over to England?
I did 2 years in India, and then I started racing in Asia for another year. So I did my first 3 years of karting just in Asia, and then I moved to England in 2012 for the first time.
Now, we've had two Indian drivers in Grand Prix racing, Naren Karthikeyan and also Karun Chanduk. Have you ever talked to them about advice in racing, or have they given you any guidance?
I mean, I've met both of them, and they both seem like nice people, and they say the way I'm going, it all looks good for me to go in F1 one day.
How big was the difference in terms of depth of competition between racing in India and racing in England?
I mean, it's a massive difference, because when I used to race in India, I was always at the front. And then when I came to England, the conditions, the track, everything was really different. So I started off midfield, and then over a year I progressed, and then won the last race of the championship.
You won the British karting championship, right?
Yeah, I did win it last year. It was a really hard battle between my teammates, Inam Ahmed, Daniel took them and me, and over the end of the year I managed to win it.
Okay. What were some of your best races?
My best race was this year in Castelletto. It was just my fifth race in senior karting, and I won both the finals, and it was my best moment so far.
You're in KF2 now. Is the talent pool in KF2 much stronger than in KF3?
I mean, the quality of drivers are pretty similar, but the experience of drivers racing you're racing against is a lot different, because they've been racing in KF2 for a lot of time, and they know exactly what to do, so just racing against them is a big deal.
Are you doing some races in India also?
Not anymore. Nothing. Just two in Europe now.
Now, I'm sure you've met Dr. Vijay Mallya. What kind of character he is?
I mean, he's a great man. He's really interested in motorsport, and he's keen for the team to do well. And he's supported me really well by bringing me to this great team. And all of now, it's all been pretty good. He's a great man to talk with and to deal with. So it's been all good so far.
Now, I was watching a video on a TV program also about the Force India karting program. Terry Fullerton, who is a karting legend, was involved, and Nico Hulkenberg was also at one of the test sessions. How much help have these two people been to you in learning the racing scene in Europe?
Terry Fullerton has been a huge help to me, because he's the one who brought me from being mid-grid to a front runner, both in the wet and the dry. And his just coaching experience has been huge for me, and that's one of the main reasons I'm here right now. And Nico Hulkenberg was one of the judges in a 1 in a billion program, and he saw me and he picked me.
What is the game plan for Mr. Jahan Daruvala next year?
I mean, I'm not sure as of now. I think I may do another year of karts or Formula karts next year.
If you do another season of karting, you think it's going to help you when you get to single-seater racing?
Yeah, I think doing another year, there's no harm. It's just more experience, and the race draft improves a lot, and it should help for cars if I go ahead.
What's your favorite karting track in Europe?
Sarno. It's a track in Italy. Mm-hmm. And it's got all sorts of corners, and since I went there, I'm always fast. I was second in the World Championships last year, and I qualified on pole this year in the WSK.
Okay, you mentioned Fernando Alonso is your hero. What was the first Formula One race you went to, and what was your first impression of the cars and the sound?
My first Formula One race I went to was the first race in Singapore, and it was the first race in the night, so it was a great pleasure to be there. It was just unbelievable, the experience. Just the cars braking, the amount of force goes onto the front tires, and it was just a great experience. It just got me more into the sport.
Are you as good in school as you are on the track?
Yeah, I would say so.
What's your favorite subject in school?
Mathematics.
Cool. Okay, Formula One, very new look this year, coming down to championship, coming down to between two drivers. Your take on the new cars and how they sound, and who do you think will be world champion?
I mean, it's a whole different era of a Formula One. The sound has people gotten used to, and it's not that great, but still, racing and the cars are a lot better this year, because people drive close to each other and are able to pass a lot easier. And I think it's going to be a tough championship, and whoever holds the nerve at the end is probably going to win it.
Do you have any preference?
Lewis Hamilton.
Cool. Okay, great talking to you. Finally, how about a message to listeners of our podcast, and please tell them about your website also.
I mean, I currently don't have a website on me, but...
You're from India and you don't have a website?
Yeah, it's strange, isn't it?
Okay, how about a message for our listeners?
I mean, it's been a great career for me so far, and support from the crowd and people around me should boost me forward. Thank you.
Okay, thank you very much.
And now, here's Tech Talk with Tim.
Greetings, listeners, for a special edition of Tech Talk. Tonight, it's Track Talk with Tim, where I focus on the exciting intricacies of a specific part of the Formula One world. Tech junkies, don't worry. This edition will be plenty technical for you, too. It won't be long before the F1 circus moseys on down to Texas, and Circuit of the Americas is one tilkadrome I really like to discuss. In particular, I think Turn 1 is, as the locals might say, fine as frog's fur. Do yourself a favor and look up turn one. I recommend you use a maps program, but you can also Google it. But you really need to see this turn from a bird's eye view to understand what makes it so interesting. In case you're having trouble finding it, turn one is the southernmost point on the track. Sure, this turn is special because it's uphill and it's the first turn in the race, but there's something extra special going on. The track width. Unlike most turns, where the width of the track stays pretty constant, turn one gets fat right before the apex, then thinner again. More specifically, while the outside of the turn has a pretty typical shape, the inside edge looks as though it's providing an extra lane, like a shortcut to the apex of the turn. It's subtle, but very intentional. What is this all about? First, let's talk a little bit about normal race strategy. By now, most of you are familiar with what's called the racing line. The racing line is the path around the track that provides the quickest lap time. The fact that cars try to follow this line at nearly all times is evidenced by the concentration of tire marks along it and the lack of marbles thrown off by degrading tires. When following the racing line, cars enter a turn from the outside, move inward around the apex, and then move back outward at the turn exit. This path is actually a few meters longer than simply hugging the inside edge of the turn, but because starting and ending a turn at the outside edge allows cars to maintain a higher speed through the turn and exit with more speed to head towards the next one, it's a faster path. It's the same thing in baseball. Hitters round the bases when they attempt doubles, triples, and inside the park home runs. Although the shortest path around the bases is to run directly from one base to the next and stop and turn sharply at 90 degrees, slowing down enough to make this turn really slows down a base runner. So, in theory, a competitive car on the racing line shouldn't be able to be overtaken. And historically, this has been a problem in Formula One. Differences in tire life, DRS, KERS, pit strategy, etc. have tried to make overtaking easier, but overtaking is still rare in F1 because if a driver attempts an overtake, it means leaving the racing line and taking a slower lap around the track. There's more to it, though. As I said before, the racing line is the path around the track that provides the quickest lap time. But overtaking isn't about driving a quick lap around the entire track. It's about surging in front of your opponent at one specific location. This may sound confusing, but looking at turn one will help you understand. The racing line for turn one starts on the outside of the curve, with a car braking before it begins to turn. That's very typical. Meanwhile, a car on the shortcut lane heads into the turn and brakes much later, since it has been able to travel in a straight line and hasn't needed to start turning yet. At this point, the turn quickly narrows and the car finds itself no longer able to hug the inside lane, but instead, it moves rapidly to the outside edge of the track, braking along the way. Try to visualize this as you look at the turn from above. In order to stay on the road, the car must be moving relatively slowly at the point it crosses the track. This awkward braking will cost the car lap time, but it has established something important. The car taking the shortcut line has arrived at the apex more quickly, and it has cut across the track from inside to outside, precisely as the car taking the racing line would like to be there. It doesn't matter that the car that took the shortcut line is now moving extremely slowly. It has cut off the car on the racing line, and its opponent will need to brake to avoid a collision. That makes the overtake stick. Overtaking isn't about driving the fastest possible lap. It's about being faster at one specific location. And in this case, it's all about being the first to the apex of turn one. In conclusion, turn one is all about setting up a conflict of interests. Driving the racing line means getting around the track as quickly as possible, but this opens you up to being cut off at turn one. Using the shortcut line of turn one every lap means losing time every lap, but getting enough of a boost where it counts to overtake an opponent and forcing them to brake where they wouldn't normally is the benefit of using the shortcut line when you need to. As always, please send feedback to info@f1weekly.com, or you can contact me directly on the forums. My new name there is Tech Tim. I'd be happy to discuss ideas for new episodes or hear what you felt about this or previous episodes. And I'm looking forward to seeing a bunch of you in person at Austin. Cheers.
Tim, keep up the good work. Another zero on your paycheck. And now let's go to the F1 Weekly Forum for 50 words on the Japanese Grand Prix. Keihei Sin writes, "We start with rain and a safety car and finish as we started. Button looked all set for a good day at the races, having made the correct tire change at the right time. But in the end, it's business as usual for the German team. Hamilton passes Rosberg on the track this time, but Rosberg could justifiably justify himself by saying he didn't have the right setup of the day. Leon Bray, the weather deals out some interesting racing. Lewis demonstrates that he is numero uno, and Danny shows everyone how to overtake. Jenson Button demonstrates why he should be the McLaren strategist, and Brundle predicts an accident involving a recovery vehicle. Good racing throughout the field. Could have been better television coverage. Hope Bianchi is okay. Dr. Mark F. Wonderful performances from the usual Rainmaster suspects, with some excellent overtakes and massive concentration shown by all. Martin Brundle's experience proves awfully prescient as poor Jules hits a trackside recovery vehicle. Our thoughts are with him at this time. Philip Pegler. A day to forget in Formula One. Thoughts or prayers are with the Bianchi family and the family of former driver Andrea De Ceteris. Congratulations to Lewis Hamilton, although that hardly seems important at the time. And finally, from Neon Zapper, the rain and the accidents made this year's Suzuka Grand Prix bittersweet. Seb was feeling motivated, and the electrical gremlins jumped from Merck to Ferrari. Aside from the hospitalization of Jules, this was another outstanding race on the 2014 calendar. So there you have it. Ness, any final thoughts?
No, sir. Just hope everybody is doing well in the F1 Weekly Familia. Season is coming to an end. Of course, it'll be a bittersweet season. And I'm hoping to get some more tech tips from Tim, our man Tim, when we get together in Texas.
Exactly. So I hope you enjoy that. And certainly it's sad that this wonderful season that started off with terrible sounding motors, everybody complaining, now it's going to go down to the wire, I think. And it's too bad that the season will be tainted by this tragedy. But it is what it is. And we still have four races to go. So there you have it. Go Fernando. I want to thank all the listeners. Good night.
Bye-bye.